Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The answer to dealing with the problem of substance abuse in this country may lie with the abusers themselves, or better said, recovering abusers. That's the message of Greg Williams, a young filmmaker with a drug abuse history. He has produced a film titled The Anonymous People, which will be given a sneak preview this Thursday at the Tivoli Theater and at several theaters around the country. It's also likely to appear later in the year on HBO. Greg's objective is to steer the conversation away from the problem of drug abuse to a discussion about solutions. Greg Williams joins us by phone from Connecticut. Greg, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Looking forward to our discussion. There are a number of organizations supporting the film, including the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse. Dan Duncan, Director of Community Services, National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area, joins us in studio. Dan, good to have you with us again.
Good to see you.
Greg, let me begin with you. You want this film to be a game changer, as you say. In what way?
Well, I think it's not the film itself, but the people in the film are game changers. This film covers the history of an emerging recovery advocacy movement calling for public disclosure of people in recovery. And what that means, I think people understand there's a lot of shame and secrecy that has shrouded addiction for a very, very long time. And over the last 10 or 15 years, and Dan was part of something even longer than that, but there's been a growing public recovery movement, just as the way breast cancer, just as the way HIV, you know, it was the people with the health condition themselves and their families and their friends who stood up and demanded a different response collectively. And so we're starting to see the birth of a very powerful grassroots advocacy movement around addiction. And the people we interviewed in this film have been at the front edge of that movement and been the leaders of that. So this film documents the people who've been at the front edge of what's going to be a transformative grassroots revolution in the way we handle addiction in America.
Well, if there is power in numbers, then there certainly is a lot of potential power here, because we're talking about, I think the number is about 20 million people, aren't we?
Yes, 23.5 million was the latest survey, and there's been a couple of different surveys that all put it right in that number, where there's over 20 million Americans who are living in long-term recovery. And that's not people who are addicted. There's still 20 million people out there who are suffering, but there's over 20 million people in long-term recovery, and it's a story that most people don't typically get to hear. I mean, we see on the news and we see in reality television the front end of addiction. We see the worst in our ERs, in our hospitals, and everywhere, the worst of addiction. But we don't necessarily get to see the people like Dan or myself who are in long-term recovery, who have necessarily, you know, pay taxes and get back to work and have recovered from this illness.
Be a little more specific, Greg, if you would, with regard to what precisely you want these people to do. I mean, it almost sounds like a political movement in one sense, and the numbers obviously are very much there. But what can they do? How do they change the discussion?
Well, okay. So, I think it's twofold. I mean, some people, and I showed the film recently down south, and some people just aren't politically engaged, and that's fine. We can change hearts and minds on a cultural level just by the knowledge that people in recovery exist. So if I'm on a bus or if I'm taking a plane out there to St. Louis on Thursday night, you know, somebody's going to ask me who's sitting next to me, you know, what are you going to do? And for years in my recovery, early on, I might be going to a recovery-related event or a conference and make up some story or kind of skirt the conversation with that person. But today, what people in this movement have taught me is, you know, I can one-on-one just change people's perception of people with addiction. So if I sit on that plane next to that person and say, you know, I'm actually going out to this recovery event where we're going to show a film and talk about recovery, and we're going to sell out this theater, 400 people, you know, all of a sudden they have a face of addiction that is maybe a face they've never seen before, of somebody stable in their recovery who's giving back to this community and all of that. So one-on-one, we can change the perception of addiction just with our neighbors, our family, our friends, our coworkers, if they know that people in recovery exist. And then politically, yes, I think there's a huge political movement now, because some of the things and challenges that we face with addiction are political, you know, discrimination around health insurance or criminal justice barriers or financial aid barriers. People in recovery or people with addiction face a lot of barriers to recovery because of some of the policies that we have in place in America. And so there's definitely the need to galvanize some political capital around this movement to really help people sustain long-term recovery.
Well, Dan, this has been part of your message for a long time. I mean, you've been coming at it from this direction since I've known you, which is a good many years now.
Right, Don. Last fall, I was sitting in my living room with my wife, and she turned to me and she goes, "Have you heard about this movie called Anonymous People?" And I said, "No." And she said, "Look at this." And so she showed me, and I looked at the trailer, and I thought, "Oh man, this is right up my alley." I mean, this Greg Williams guy, is talking my language. And so, yeah, I totally buy into the concept that the conversation has to change. You know, the National Council where I work was founded in 1945 to confront stigma, to break it down and get rid of it. And here it is, 2013, and we're still dealing with stigma. And a lot of it comes with public perception. And I think, you know, everybody seems to know somebody who went through treatment and they're back out drinking or drugging, ergo treatment doesn't work, it's a waste of time and money. That plays out into insurance practices, political decisions, as Greg mentioned. What they don't hear from necessarily is people like me. I'm in long-term recovery. I haven't had a drink or a drug since 1980. There's a lot of us. I'm not unique at all. There's millions of us, you know, but we're silent, we're hidden, we're quiet. And in part, it's because it's easier not to talk about it. You know, it's because of the social stigma. If I tell somebody I'm an alcoholic, well, there's an immediate perception surrounding that. But if we start coming out and talking about this appropriately, I think Greg's absolutely correct that we can change the language and change the perceptions.
Well, once the perception is changed, and it's on a case-by-case basis, as Greg indicated, talking to someone on an air flight out to St. Louis, once the perception is changed, what would you, and Greg, I'll ask you to follow up on this, what would you expect to happen?
What I would like to see happen is that we start approaching addiction as a public health issue, as we do so many other illnesses and diseases. We're learning. We continue to learn. You and I have talked on the show before about how much we've learned in recent years from brain research about just how addiction happens in the neurology of the brain. We should put that information into practice. And we are at the National Council with our prevention programming for youth, but it's also starting to play into how we treat it. But even with treatment, there's been a bias, discrimination that I've observed in the years that I've worked in the field, which is 29 years, of insurance kind of turning its back and not paying for treatment for people who are seeking help. And you see it in mental health, you see it in addiction. That's not right. They're getting away with murder. Why should somebody who has an addiction be less able to get help when they need it than somebody who's suffering from cancer, heart disease, or whatever?
Right. And Greg, do you want to follow up on that?
Yeah, and I mean, he hit all the sure. strong points from a policy perspective. From a culture perspective, I would like to just see recovery normalized. I mean, you got 1 in 10 Americans who are living in long-term recovery, yet we're a marginalized group of people. And culturally, wouldn't it be cool 5 years, 10 years from now where, you know, we just made recovery culturally acceptable life status, just the way somebody with diabetes is or cancer survivor is. It's not, you know, it's not this scarlet letter or anything like that. It's just, it's normal and it's part of life. I mean, 1 in 10 people who use an addictive substance become addicted. And you know, the sad part about it is 9 out of 10 people don't seek treatment in America. And the number one reason they don't seek treatment is because they don't think they need it. And that's part to the denial of the illness, but it's in part because people in recovery aren't normalized, and we don't see the face of what treatment and recovery can do in people. So if we knew our police officers, our nurses, our teachers, our doctors, if we knew about their recovery statuses, it would attract a lot more people to want to seek recovery, and we could really change the culture.
You know, I just want to remind our audience that we had David Sheff on our program a couple of weeks ago, the author of the book Clean, and he's done a lot of writing dealing with substance abuse. His own son was victimized by it and came out of it okay. But here's what David Sheff is saying. He claims that drug abuse is a disease that is preventable and treatable. And, quote, "We must acknowledge addiction as an illness and not just bad behavior, because we punish bad behavior. We treat illness." You, Greg and Dan, and David Sheff are right on the same page here, aren't you?
We are. And there are others who are saying the same thing. And some of the more public people, Patrick Kennedy has been very outspoken on this issue. Christopher Lawford, Peter Lawford's son, his cousin, same thing. I think more and more voices are emerging, basically saying the same thing. It's time for us to approach substance abuse, addiction from a different angle. And I think, you know, if we do that down the road, we're going to see better results. I don't think it'll be quick, dramatic, as we might like. I think it's going to take time. But, you know, it's turning – it's like Obama used to talk about turning a big ship around in the ocean. You know, you can't do it quickly. It takes a while. But it's a start.
Right. And the sad part is Dan works for an organization that was founded in 1945. And the woman who founded that organization, Marty Mann, who we study in the film and cover in the film, said exactly that. You know, in the 1940s, she stood up in a March of Times newsreel, and it's in the film, that we should be treating this as a health issue, you know, not in jails. And she says this, you know, in 1940s, and it followed up. And you know, so the sad part is we've been talking about this for a very, very long time in America. And it's just, you know, the hard part is people have a tough time looking past the behavior piece of addiction, the end stage piece of addiction. And we just need to start thinking a little more holistically and really not associating that behavior as that person's intentions, but that person is a sick person. I mean, 80% of people who are in our criminal justice system have an alcohol or other drug problem. And, you know, we're not getting anything collectively as a society by spending $40,000 to $50,000 to $60,000 a year locking them up without helping them with their underlying illness that put them behind bars in the first place. So it just, it doesn't make much sense to continue to try to swim upstream on this illness. And we know more today than we've ever known before on how to do a better job.
Well, it's obviously it takes time. I don't know as it takes 70 years, Dan Duncan, to turn that ship around, but apparently it's taken that long since the banner was first raised back in the 40s. I have to take a break now. We'll do that now. My guest is filmmaker Greg Williams. He is the producer, director, and the man behind The Anonymous People, which is going to be shown later this week at the Tivoli Theater. I'll have more on that a little bit later. With me in studio, Greg, by the way, is on the phone in Connecticut, joining us from there. Dan Duncan is Director of Community Service for the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. Back to continue our conversation, and of course, we want to make you a part of it. Give us a call if you'd like to get involved. Should we approach the drug abuse problem in this country? What are your thoughts? Give us a call, 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. We'll take an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. You can send us a tweet at STL on air, and we're reachable through Facebook. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on drug abuse and recovery and how recovering abusers can be used to really coalesce in this nation and get people thinking about the drug problem and how to deal with it in a much different way. My guest calling from Connecticut is Greg Williams. He's the producer of The Anonymous People, a film which will be shown here later in the week. And also with me in studio is Dan Council, who is the associate executive director, I might say, of the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. Dan, I know that's a new title, and congratulations.
Thank you.
For that. Greg, let me come back to you. One of the things I noticed in the trailer, and unfortunately that's all I've been able to see of your film so far, what I noticed in particular was the people that you have featured in your film look different to me. They don't look like what we might call the stereotype, kind of an inner city ragtag, you know, brown bag on the corner, drug abusers. These are people with responsible jobs and people that we would run into in every line of work. That was intentional, I'm sure.
Well, yeah. I mean, I wanted to give a voice to people who typically don't get a voice. I mean, Dan, you got into recovery in 1985, was it?
1980.
I mean, people don't know Dan Duncan exists. And there's millions of Dan Duncans out there. And Greg Williams, I got into recovery in 2001. And so most of the people in our film are what we call in long-term recovery. And, you know, for me, that means I haven't used alcohol or other drugs for over 11 years. And so we have people with 30 years, 40 years of recovery, of sustained long-term recovery. And I really wanted to bring them into the conversation in a way that might have not necessarily been done before, because most addiction documentaries do cover the dark side or the dysfunctional side of addiction. And that's an important side of the story. I'm not saying that's not part of this illness. It's only, you know, of the homeless, bottom of the barrel people with addiction, it's really only 3% of the people with addiction that are there who are typical pictures of people with addiction, where 70% of people with this illness are employed. I mean, it's an amazing number of people who are just, you know, employed, and we just don't associate them with having an alcohol or drug problem. The biggest people at stake in America for not addressing this issue are employers. Lost productivity in the workplace is the number one issue for what's hurting our economy in terms of addiction, is the lost productivity in the workplace. And so just shining a light on Kristen Johnston, who's an Emmy Award-winning actress, or Chris Herron, who's a former NBA basketball player, Patrick Kennedy, you know, and others, it really helps people to understand that this illness impacts people from all walks of life.
And these are people that you see all the time, Dan.
I do. Yeah. In all the years I've worked in the field, I've seen people from every walk of life, every age, race, color, suffer from this illness. I see how it impacts families. When I came into the field, it was as a counselor. And then and now, I want recovery for everybody that suffers from this. I want people to get help sooner, easier. Because I've experienced both sides of it personally, obviously, and it's addiction is no fun. It ruins your life. It can kill you prematurely, definitely. And conversely, recovery gives you the freedom to pursue everything and anything you want to, and achieve your goals and aspirations, and achieve your potential.
We've talked about the criminal justice system a moment or two ago, and I wanted to bring this up before going to the phones, because we have a number of people who want to get into the conversation. But we're having some success here, and Greg, I'm sure you've noticed it elsewhere, with these so-called drug courts, which is a part of the new approach, Dan, that you were alluding to a little while ago. What do you think of that concept, Greg?
Well, I think they're proven effective, you know, in different respects. I'm not a personal expert on the drug courts per se. I mean, they're highly variable depending on which district and what state you live in. But the idea is valid, and it's important that in lieu of incarceration, we can present people with options. And so many offenders for years in the 80s, 90s, and 2000s never had an option. You get arrested with a bag of cocaine or a bag of marijuana, and, you know, it's in your state, if that's the charge, you get locked up. You don't get any treatment. You don't get any education related to your underlying health issue. And so the concept behind, you know, holding somebody accountable for actions that they might have committed during the act of addiction, but educating them about their illness and offering them treatment and other options in lieu of incarceration makes a whole lot of sense for a lot of people. And there's a lot of people who, you know, the sad part, my hesitancy with the drug court system is that hopefully people don't need to enter the criminal justice system to get treatment. And the sad part is most of our public sector services in this country now, if you, like in Connecticut, if you don't get incarcerated as a teenager or get into the juvenile justice system, you can't get treatment because your health insurance company is not providing treatment, and your parents or your family can't pay cash because it's so expensive. So I want to preface that just by saying it's important that we provide treatment and resources for people who aren't yet in the criminal justice system. That would be really true movement, that we don't need to wait till somebody has that kind of involvement before offering them some help.
But if we do, Dan, you don't want to warehouse people like that. That's not doing any good at all.
No, it basically doesn't. If somebody goes in with an addiction, they usually come out with an addiction. Yeah. And if anything, they're worse.
Well, let's go to the phones. We had a call that has since dropped, unfortunately, from someone named Anna, who identified herself as a former judge. She's left, unfortunately, if she's still out there. And I'd love to hear from you. So if you want to give us a call back, we'll take it right away. Let's go to those phones. And we'll start with Deb calling from St. Louis. Deb, thanks for being with us and thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you so much. Excuse me for being a little nervous. Thanks for taking my call. This is a wonderful show.
You're among friends. And don't be nervous.
What I'm going to do is frame this as three questions because I think it'll be most concise. The only thing I'm concerned about of going completely in the direction of being as non-judgmental as possible and removing a moral dimension is, number one, the most successful program in the country, Alcoholics Anonymous, is framed with a moral dimension. Number two, isn't it true that there has to be some moral dimension to the whole idea of getting well, or at least getting better, to give people the sense of agency that this is something they need to do? And number three, don't you also need some kind of moral sense of the effect that addiction not only has on the person themselves, but on a whole lot of people close to them and not so close to them, who are nonetheless hurt, sometimes grievously, by the effects of that addiction? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Deb, thanks for the call. Greg, do you want to take a stab at that?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think it's so true. I think when we get into the actual pathways, I mean, she talked about Alcoholics Anonymous, and there's many pathways to recovery today, and that is definitely one of the most prominent and successful programs of long-term recovery. And so it's very important in those programs for people to be part of a community and collectively understand about their behavior and related to their illness and all of that stuff, and be held accountable for actions that they take in recovery. And that's all, you know, this new movement kind of frames it under the idea of positive peer support. And it's a really simple concept that the founders of Alcoholics Anonymous figured out in 1935, is that community and people with like-minded associations can really help one another to promote recovery and attract people to living that lifestyle and hold other people accountable in that way. So today we have 258 other fellowships and support groups modeled after Alcoholics Anonymous, and goes far and wide past addiction, as you know. And so every modern day cancer support group and all of that has roots founded in Alcoholics Anonymous. So it's really, you know, it's an important component of recovery. And you know, what this film and people in this movement are calling is it's not only the stick that can help people get recovery, but it's also the carrot. And we need to put the carrot out there for people and show people Dan Duncan and Greg Williams and other people that can help people attract them to that lifestyle.
Dan, your thoughts? Do you want to respond to Deb?
Well, I think Deb understands very well, and she stated it well, that, you know, really personal accountability is at the core of recovery. I mean, you are taking responsibility for your own behavior, your own issues, and cleaning up your past as best you can and moving on in life. And I think that's what anybody can expect or hope for somebody who has this kind of problem.
Yeah. We have an email from Tom while we're talking about AA. Tom writes, if you have not already seen it, you might appreciate the letter to the media from Alcoholics Anonymous on its website on the subject of anonymity, asking for continuing the policy of anonymity for members of AA. Had you seen that, Greg?
I am all too familiar with the subject of anonymity, hence the title of the film, The Anonymous People. And we cover the subject of anonymity quite expansively in the film. And that, if you look from the 40s to now, what has held back the recovery movement, the confusion around anonymity. And I would, you know, love to, you know, talk to people about Marty Mann and Harold Hughes and others who understood that standing up as a person in recovery doesn't necessarily divulge a person's anonymity if they're a member of a particular 12-step group. And it doesn't put a face or attach that group politically. So there's a couple traditions, and most people aren't fully familiar with the traditions of the 12-step groups. And, you know, they don't have any political affiliations. They don't have individual representatives publicly of those things at the level of press, radio, and films. And so what this new movement is calling for is really people in recovery to step forward as individuals, not as representatives of any particular pathway of recovery, but also to unite other pathways of recovery under this umbrella, because it impacts all of us. So there's programs called Life Ring and, you know, Narcotics Anonymous and Al-Anon. There's many, many ways that people get well today. Some people find recovery in church. But all of us face the same discriminatory barriers and policies and culture challenges in terms of recovery from addiction. So understanding that we can bring different pathways together and promote recovery without necessarily divulging anyone's anonymity and respecting those traditions found in those programs.
Dan, you're sitting here nodding with everything that Greg said.
Well, it's well stated. Yeah. You know, this is an issue that even using the word anonymity brings up fears, I think, for some people that are involved with 12 steps. And it's not about breaking your anonymity as far as your membership in any group. It's about standing up as a person in recovery and being part of the solution, putting a face to voice to recovery.
Let's go back to the phones, and we'll bring in Tom, our first caller of the day. He's been waiting the longest, that is. Tom in South City, go ahead.
Thank you. I didn't mean to be both the emailer and the caller.
I didn't realize you were one and the same.
But what I wanted to share is that, first, I applaud these efforts that your guests are making. I come from a family that's affected by alcoholism and addiction and has lost several members. Myself, I'm blessed to be 25 years clean and sober, but I work with several different 12-step fellowships, and right now I'm being anonymous because you can't see my face, and I'm not giving you my last name. I do work with several different organizations, and I find that for those of us who are in recovery and are trying to take part in this kind of effort that you're discussing, there's an AA pamphlet called Understanding Anonymity. And regardless of which 12-step fellowship you're in, I think this can be one of the most helpful guides, because it can be fairly tricky. And not all the 12-step fellowships have been around long enough to develop detailed literature on the topic. So, you know, if I were in some other newer 12-step fellowship and I'm looking for guidance on this, it might be kind of hard to get something that really talks you through the different situations. And so for anyone who's trying to understand anonymity, you know, in this kind of an effort, I would recommend that piece of literature. It's so essential. I know the New York Times published some letters a few years ago saying that maybe we don't need to be anonymous anymore. And I think it's very misguided idea, and I'm glad you all are not championing that view. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Tom. Dan, did you want to respond in?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that pamphlet, and I agree with Tom. It really helps you delineate the understanding of what anonymity means and does not mean as prescribed by the 12-step movement.
And can I just add,
sure.
Tom's points are great, and I read that New York Times article 2.5 years ago, and that article really jump-started my drive to want to make this film in a larger way. And that reporter didn't want to talk to me about that article, first of all, but because it's small-minded in the sense that, A, recovery happens in a lot of ways. I mean, we have 23.5 million people in recovery in America. Only 1 million find recovery in AA. So there's smart recovery. There's many pathways that people get better, and so AA, just because it's culturally understood and culturally powerful in the recovery movement, isn't the only way to get better, first of all. And second of all, there was a pamphlet that Dan Duncan and others championed back in the 1990s called Advocacy with Anonymity, which is also such an important pamphlet for anybody thinking about speaking publicly about their recovery and they're a member of an anonymous program. You can just Google Advocacy with Anonymity and it'll come up. And basically that pamphlet discusses the exact traditions related to 12-step membership and public disclosure of your recovery status. And so it's a great tool.
Let's take another call. Derek is going to bring up a subject that always comes up during these discussions. So let's bring him in. Go ahead, Derek.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I just wanted to bring up, I believe I could be wrong, I think it's Poland where they decriminalized essentially all drugs. And when people, you know, come in with an addiction issue, instead of spending the money towards incarceration, they put it towards treatment and, you know, helping, getting the person the help they need. And they have seen, you know, addiction rates for all drugs plummet. So we have that data and, you know, we know that it works. However, we have a system in place currently where people are making money off people sitting in prison, and they're making a lot of money, and they have lobbyists in Washington that are, you know, pushing for this. So could we ever see, a switch towards decriminalization and, you know, addressing the issue at hand of addiction and getting people the help that they need?
Derek,
thanks. I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
I'm going to send that to Dan Duncan first. Dan's been around a little bit longer than Greg and gone through this debate, I'm sure, many, many times.
Almost daily, I think. Well, I don't disagree with Derek. I think that we are moving in that direction gradually, albeit slowly, toward decriminalization. We're seeing some efforts here in Missouri. And I'm glad he made a difference. He didn't say legalization because we have a lot of folks who would like to see us go from one extreme to the other. The one extreme I refer to is essentially trying to punish our way out of the problem. You and I have talked about it, Don. The other extreme would be just to legalize and say, do what you want, and that's not going to work. And I think it's a terrible idea. But to decriminalize would, depending on how you do it, I have to put that caveat in there, make sense to not make criminals out of people who are using drugs necessarily unless they do criminal behavior that we have no choice, but to do the things that we're talking about, improve prevention, and no doubt that we have to do much better in terms of prevention and helping youth avoid this direction, but also treatment. And if we do more public education, and I mean some substantial public education, do much, much better in prevention and make treatment available for folks who need it when they need it, I think we would balance this problem out and see substantial reduction in numbers of problems over time.
Greg, we're seeing a lot of decriminalization of marijuana here in the city of St. Louis. Bill's just been passed to that effect. Your thoughts on the decriminalization issue?
You know, it's funny. It's definitely people always want to talk about drug policy issues, and I'm all for understanding that people have an illness and Dan framed it perfectly. It's one extreme to the other, and I think that it's important that people in recovery understand that the recovery movement, it doesn't really matter if drugs are illegal or not in many respects, because we can promote recovery as a public health issue and addiction as a public health issue regardless of what drug policy we have on the books. Their intersection, of course, our biggest drug problem in America is alcohol. And so, it's in prescription drugs now. And so we have legal drugs on the books that are just as challenging in terms of regulatory control and cost to our society and incarceration and all of that. So drug policy is less of an issue than the public health model for improving this. And Derek's other point about the lobbyists, the only way we're going to change this is with a constituency of consequence. We don't have that in America, a constituency of consequence who will stand up and say, no, let's not open another prison. Let's open another treatment program, or let's open a recovery program. And we don't have that yet. But there's 23 million of us with the potential in our families who can become that. And that's what this film kind of articulates and trying to grow that so that we can have powerful voices and voters who can essentially start to elect politicians who aren't going to just take money from the prison industrial complex.
That's filmmaker Greg Williams. He's produced The Anonymous People, which will be showing at the Tivoli Theater on Thursday. I'll have specifics on that when we come back after a break. With me in studio is Dan Duncan, the Associate Executive Director for the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. Back to continue the conversation and take more of your calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back as we continue our conversation on drug issues with filmmaker Greg Williams, the producer of The Anonymous People, and Dan Duncan, who is with the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area. The sneak preview of The Anonymous People is going to be shown this Thursday at 7 o'clock at the Tivoli Theater in University City. It will be followed by a discussion with the filmmaker Williams. We have information on our website, stlpublicradio.org, including information on acquiring tickets, and there are still some left, Dan tells me. And we also have a link to the National Council on Alcoholism and Drug Abuse for the St. Louis area website, so visit that if you want to learn more about that organization. Let me come back with an email. As long as we were talking about marijuana a moment ago, we have an email from Laura who says, I've been sober for 18 plus years, but I recently began smoking marijuana a bit. Consequently, I no longer feel welcome legitimately at AA. Why is pot lumped in with other drugs? I'm not aware of it killing anyone or even causing bad behavior. What do you think, Dan?
Well, I think that may be a conversation for another show, another time. Yeah. It's a mood-altering drug. It is addictive, and I don't think that I can answer for that bigger question other than say that.
All right. Did you want to comment at all on that, Greg? Shall we move on?
No, I mean, I would just say that if somebody doesn't feel welcome at a recovery program of their choice, to definitely seek out other recovery programs where somebody feels, you know, welcome. And that doesn't mean that there is one out there that will welcome her. But I just think that it's important that people understand, you know, AA isn't the only pathway to recovery, and it has helped millions and millions and millions of people. It's an amazing program, but maybe it's not the best fit for her, and maybe there's a different recovery program out there that she would feel better at.
Let's go back to the phones, and this time we'll bring in Claire, who's been very patient. Claire, thanks for waiting, and go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've got three quick things. One is I looked up Tradition 11 because you were talking about anonymity, and the basic part of that says anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. So basically, you know, I'm not attaching myself to AA if I talk, or anybody, I mean, not necessarily me, but also the filmmakers, it's just not bringing it into AA. The second thing is I have 31 years, and I know a lot of people, well, 10 to 12 people that have long-term sobriety, 14 to 30 years, and all of them are outspoken and willing to say who and what they are, except for, like, we have a lawyer who's worried about her job, and we have a counselor, and we have teachers and all sorts of people that are stepping up, and it's a small start, but without knowing anything before about the film, we do have people reaching out, and I am from St. Louis, so it's still that area. And then the last thing, I'm glad to hear you say there's other pathways to recovery. I have a son who's not in any kind of recovery, and he's an atheist, and that just makes AA impossible for him. So that's all. If you have suggestions about some of the alternative paths to recovery, that'd be great. If not, I'll start researching. Thanks, Bob.
Thanks, Claire. Greg?
Yeah, no, thank you for calling in. One program that comes to mind is a program called Smart Recovery. You might want to look that one up. They have definitely a different approach than the traditional 12-step programs. And also in the 12-step programs, if for young people, if you seek out young people's specific groups, sometimes that can help in terms of finding peers who relate and connect on a different level. A lot of times young people, you know, I got into recovery when I was 17, and, you know, you go into meetings and you find a lot of older folks that you might not associate with their life experiences and those things. So it was important for young people to try to find positive peer relationships and groups that are culturally relevant to them at that age group. And so those are my two recommendations around that. And then, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm loving the change in America where people are more willing to talk about their recovery status, because that's how we get to solutions. We've talked about problems for addiction for a very, very long time, but talking about recovery and promoting recovery and attracting people to recovery is part of the solution.
Tell me, Greg, how did you get into this world? I know that you started using drugs at a very young age. What was going on in your life at that time?
Well, you know, it was interesting. My story is pretty unique, or not. I don't know. I didn't necessarily have any particular moment or thing that happened to me that I can say, oh, that's what happened. I mean, you know, whether it's, you know, some childhood trauma or things like that, which is an indicator for some. You know, for me, it was really textbook pathology, where at 12, 13 years old, I tried alcohol for the first time, and it did something for me that I never, you know, thought I could do for myself. And you know, I started to want to do that more. So all of a sudden, baseball and basketball and these other things became less important, and I chased, you know, finding ways to drink, and quickly got into marijuana because it was easier to find for me at that age, and, you know, migrated to prescription pills. And I was, you know, for an adolescent, I was pretty textbook. It's,
you know, for with a developing brain, we can go from non-use to addiction in a period of 18 months. And for adults with developed brains, it might take 10 years. But I know that stuff today. I didn't know that then. No one educated me on drugs are bad, but they didn't educate me on the pathology of addiction and all that kind of stuff. And so ultimately, my life got pretty hectic pretty quick in terms of car accidents and tough relationships with my family and lots of things that addiction brought. And ultimately, my family probably saved my life at 17 years old when they just, you know, weren't going to accept it anymore. And they reached out for help and they found healthcare providers who knew about addiction and helped me get into treatment. And, you know, I was lucky enough to find some, to get into a recovery house, which is, you know, a 90-day program after treatment, which really helped establish myself in terms of getting a job and getting back into society. Because a lot of times people look at, you know, treatment, and right now it's, we used to say it's 28 days, and right now it's more like 5 days or 7 days, but, you know, we used to treat addiction like an infectious disease. You send somebody through the washing machine, they come out the other side, and they're cured. And we created this perception that that's what addiction was. And today we know it's a chronic health problem, much like asthma or diabetes or heart disease or anything like that, where we need ongoing management and support to help improve outcomes with that. And so I was able to find those kind of supports at 17, and, you know, lucky enough to go to college and be successful in college and get a job in the media business, and, you know, was able to chase some dreams. And recovery gave me a lot of things that I never even dreamed I wanted and didn't even know I needed, but it really freed me from addiction in a way that I was able to do anything and everything that I want to do in my life today.
You know, your story could be right out of the pages of that David Sheff book, Clean, that I was mentioning a short time ago. Our brains are developing at the age when you were started taking drugs, where there's no stop button. You know, that right. Young people just take off and they're reckless and do this sort of thing. He tells the story of his son, who with another fellow were spending a night at a friend's house. The parents were gone, so they went into the liquor cabinet to try it. And the friend took a swallow and spit it out. He couldn't stand the taste. But Chef's son took a swallow and really, really liked it, and then took another glass full of it. And that is the difference. His predisposition to that was very, very obvious, and it cost him several years of his life until he came around. It's quite a story. It's quite a story, Greg.
It's 9 out of 10 people with this health problem started using in adolescence. And so that's one thing we cover in the film is, you know, when we start looking at a 30-year-old or a 40-year-old with who is doing some bad behavior related to addiction, we need to see them as a child. I mean, that is when the onset, 9 out of 10 of people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s started using when their brain was developing as an adolescent. And so we need to start understanding that this is really a disease of adolescence and treating it as such. And that way, you know, Dan touched on you know, prevention and treatment. And right now in America, you know, if you take a dollar related to addiction, 98 cents of that dollar is spent on cleaning up the wreckage of addiction and only 2% is prevention or treatment. And so that equation isn't quite right. There's a lot of growth that we can do.
Dan, we've talked about this before, but what they're learning about the brain, particularly the developing brain, is really critical with regard to understanding this whole issue of abuse.
It is, and it's been being referred to more and more as a pediatric illness. With that understanding, it can't help but take you to a place to say, well, okay, then logically, this is where we need to go. We need to go toward prevention. We need to do a better job with our youth educating and using the science to their advantage and helping them understand what it is they're up against.
You know, I'm going to change subject just a little bit because I want to be sure to get this in with you, Greg. It's not exactly a science, but what you've done to finance this film of yours is an emerging phenomenon, I think, in American society today. You used Kickstarter to fund your film. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things. I didn't set out to use Kickstarter. I thought that the media industry would fund the film like they'd fund other films, but just like the criminal justice industry, they have some entrenched logic in how they want to cover addiction. And there's some people out there making a lot of money off addiction-related programming and sensational programming. And so they didn't really want to be challenged in that way. And I wasn't able to find somebody who really believed in telling the recovery story. And because of that, I set out on the road, and I went into personal debt at first to shoot our first month and a half of footage. And I was kind of stuck after that. I had a good promo reel, and they're just the companies that exist in this industry for documentaries just weren't interested in the topic weren't interested in the angle of the topic that I was interested in, and wasn't able to find a home. And it was last summer when we were coming up on Recovery Month. Every September is National Recovery Month, and there's marches and rallies for the last 10 years. And I really wanted to capture some of that for people to understand how big this movement is starting to become. Last year, 100,000 people across America all went to recovery events during the month of September. And so that's a pretty significant number. It's still not where we need to be, but we're starting to get more. So I wanted to capture that, and I put it out to the world on Kickstarter, and I said, is there people out there who are interested in helping me finish this project? And it was amazing that the recovery community and the people in it came to the call, and folks like NCADD St. Louis, became backers of the film, and it really created a whole new distribution channel and way to reach people without a big corporate influence controlling the content of the project.
Yeah, this is for people who don't know about Kickstarter, it's really an opportunity for anybody, just plain folks, to participate in finance, and you can do it with just a few dollars or a lot of dollars if you want to. What was the largest amount you received from a single source?
Well, one of our co-executive producers, contributed $10,000 to become an executive producer and help me on the film. But it also larger. We set a goal for $45,000, and we ended up raising $85,000 just in that campaign alone. But it also connected me to foundations, and one particular foundation, the Morgan Le Fay Foundation, helped me pretty much finish this movie single-handedly. And so it was a way to a lot of filmmakers and creative types are scared to put their work out there because somebody's going to steal their idea. And so Kickstarter is for people who've developed their idea to such a point where they feel like, no one else can do it. You're the right person to do it. And that's part of why people invest in your project, because they think you're the right person to do it. And, it's a cool way because a lot of people gave $25 and basically they're just pre-buying their DVD. So if it's a film that you believe in, you can essentially help the filmmaker or the author of the book or the inventor fund their project during the production phase and be an early adopter and just pre-buy your DVD. So if it's a film that, people saw this Kickstarter and they said, oh, well, I would buy this film anyways, so I'll give him $25, help him finish the movie, and when he's done, he's going to send me a DVD, and I already pre-bought it. So it's a nice way to finance creative work.
We only have a minute left. I love your line as to what you want to do. You want to sensationalize recovery, and that's what this the film is designed to do. Correct?
Yeah, correct. It's time. I mean, we have amazing, amazing people in recovery, and it's time we start celebrating them and sensationalizing the idea because it's powerful. 23 million people, that's a power, and that, they can get well.
In 30 seconds, Dan, do you want to put a cap on your side of this program?
Well, I would just invite people to come Thursday night. I think they'll enjoy it. I haven't seen the whole film, but at which I've seen, I'm excited about, and I think Greg is a good representative of this effort, and I would encourage you to come to the Tivoli Thursday night.
Okay, the film is The Anonymous People. It'll be shown Thursday at the Tivoli Theater in U City. Starts at 7 o'clock. Our guest, Greg Williams, who's joining us from Connecticut today, the producer of the film, will be there to take your questions, and we'll look forward to having you in St. Louis. Greg, thanks so much for being on the program.
Thanks for having me. It was great.
Dan Duncan, thank you so much. Always great to
see
you.
Don.
And tomorrow we'll continue with St. Louis on the Air. We'll find out what NPR's Peter Sagal found out about the Constitution. That is the U.S. Constitution. That is our Peter Sagal. The Constitution in the 21st century. He traveled across the country on a Harley-Davidson as part of a PBS series to get input from folks on what they think, know, or don't know about our Constitution. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.